Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Transitions, building resilient communities across the United States and the world that are able to withstand severe energy, climate, or economic shocks while creating a better quality of life in the process. There are 360 official transition towns in 31 countries, including 85 in this country, with over 100 more groups in this country interested. The movement began in a small British town in 2006. Most transition towns in this country are about 2 years old, and they share a common purpose: to reduce fossil fuel use, to help mitigate climate change by relocalizing. That means shifting production closer to home. If enough food, building supplies, energy, and goods are sourced locally, towns and neighborhoods could become resilient, survive, and even prosper when oil becomes scarce. The movement is also about creating functioning communities, with the idea that strong neighborhood networks will help towns to weather future energy shocks. As our guest today, we have Patricia Benson. Patricia is a board member of Transition USA and is living in a transition community. She's been engaged in different aspects of environmental sustainability for a number of years now. Her experience includes market gardening, environmental education, curriculum media development, advocacy for environmental justice. She's lived on a family dairy farm in Minnesota, on national forest land in the wilderness, and in urban and rural communities. She is a member of the leadership teams with Lutherans Restoring Creation and with the Minnesota Episcopal Environmental Stewardship Commission. And she's made many presentations to introduce transition initiatives. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about these communities this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Should be a really interesting conversation. So, one of the premises of all of this is that there are certain truths that should be self-evident. And one is that life with dramatically lower energy consumption is inevitable, and we darn well better take charge of the issue ourselves.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's better to plan than to react, and that's the basis behind all of this.
And tell me about the origins of the whole movement. It started, is my understanding, in Kinsale, Ireland.
Right. Rob Hopkins is a permaculture instructor, and he was working with his class, and they basically were wondering what would happen if you took the principles of permaculture design, which is basically a food design process that is looking at balanced ecological systems, and apply those principles to a community. And they did it as a class project, and then they took it over to the basically the city council, the town council, and said, you know, what do you guys think of this? And the town council responded very positively, ended up adopting it, and it started the wheels rolling, I guess. And from there, it's just grown.
Would you say that most of these communities around the world are formed because people are looking at climate change issues, they're looking at peak oil issues, they're looking at what's happening with the economy, and people are frightened and simply must create an alternative?
Well, that's part of it, I would think, in the motivation for people maybe initially joining the conversation. But one of the premises of transition is that we're really looking at a positive image, that as long as we focus our energy on what's wrong, we tend to get bogged down in arguments about what the best results are. And what transition is saying, instead of focusing on what's wrong, let's focus on what's right. Let's create a positive vision of our community 20 years from now and look at what, if we recognize the truth that we are going to clearly have to do something to fix the mess that we're in today, then, you know, what can we do? What do we want our community to look like? And create that positive vision of what a dynamic, engaged community would look like in a post-carbon world. And then from that vision, backcast and think about what are the steps we need to take to get there. and then get to work.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about new communities that are springing up in various parts of the world that are transition communities, or can you have transitions in the middle of a large city?
Oh, definitely. This is not about leaving where we are. But identification, or the definition of resilience, which is the identifying factor of transition towns, is becoming resilient communities. The definition of resilience is basically being able to adapt to stresses and retain the essentials of our identity. So we don't want to lose what it is that makes our community valuable today. We want to look at what the essence of our community is that we treasure, and we want to take that and retain that and figure out how to retain that in response to the challenges, whatever challenges are coming our way, whether it's the economy or energy price escalation, reduced access to energy, climate change issues, disaster issues, whatever they are, that we can retain that essence of who we are in a healthy, dynamic way.
And would you be able to tell immediately, and if so, how, if you were in a transition community?
I'm not sure. There are a lot of different groups out there that are doing work that's similar to transition. When I first connected with Transition Towns, the piece for me that made it different from other, eco-communities, eco-villages, Natural Step, there's tons of people out there doing outstanding work. The difference for me with transition was that it was focused more on relationship than it was on project. And that would be the piece that if you've got a healthy transition initiative going, I would think that it would be the fun in the process. That there's a lot of emphasis on building community relationship, on knowing your neighbors, on standing together as a community planning resilience, rather than a focus on what my household can do. That's part of it, but it definitely doesn't end there. It doesn't even start there. It starts at the community level and breaks down to the household level, rather than me changing light bulbs and, you know, changing my transportation patterns and things like that. It's more looking at a community systems response. So I would think that if you were in a transition town that is working effectively and has really taken off in the end, that you would be able to see that because of the relationship aspect.
And what is the response? Are we talking about gardens? Are we talking about biking to work? Are we talking about new kinds of employment? What is it?
All of the above. One of the beauties of transition is that it's a process that engages people. It presents really good information. It really gets to the core of the problem. This is what the issue is. And then it's a process for engaging the community wisdom in crafting a response. And that response is going to look different depending on where you live. I live in Minnesota, and I'm in an area where our growing season this year looks shorter than ever. But for me, the local food responses that I'm going to have to implement up here in central Minnesota are far different from what someone is going to have to implement in South Carolina. So it's based on engaging the community and then having the community come up with those projects. Resilience indicators would be looking at transportation, how many people have to leave town to go to work, how many miles do they have to drive. The lower that number is, the more resilient your community is. It would be looking at where you resource your building supplies, where you get your food from, how you heat and cool your home. All of those kinds of aspects are part of this.
Most of these communities have big gardens, right? And people have been able to grow a lot of food and take care of needy people in communities because they grow so much food.
Exactly. Transition US sponsored with 350.org this year the 350 Home and Garden Challenge. And one of the things that we were seeking to do was to really build and strengthen that part of this aspect of looking at your home and your energy, things that you could do related to that, but also really focusing on getting those gardens planted and a local food supply.
Mm-hmm. And what about, let's look at this huge issue right now, people being unemployed, of trying to transition into a greener economy and green energy jobs, et cetera. How do you take on that issue of making sure that people have enough money to live on?
That is a huge challenge. I think that relocalization is one of the pieces that we're working for in transition. And what that means is that as my neighbors and my home, we start becoming more interdependent and bringing the sources of all of our needs, our consumer needs, closer to home, that what that in turn does is create some jobs. So there are some big economic indicators out there for, you know, the big picture in the sense of green energy. I know the Union of Concerned Scientists is going to be issuing a report that is a study on just that and what the economy and green energy will look like in rural communities in the Midwest. But it's also about me raising chickens and exchanging those chickens for someone who is recycling, you know, clothing or whatever needs that we have, that we get that production down on a more local level. It creates jobs in that sense. Transition towns in the United States are fairly new yet, and we're in the process of developing some of those pieces. I know that one of the pieces that we look at is shifting away from a monetary-based economy exclusively and moving into also a bartering economy.
Mm.
So in Northfield, for example, they're in the process of creating a community exchange that's a bartering type of system where you can bank your labor rather than banking a paycheck. And then you can draw from that pool, too. So the community that's involved in the bartering exchange can barter, for example, babysitting for help putting in new windows or something like that. So it's really broad. And that, I would say, is the piece that's been the biggest challenge. Is how do we transition an economy away from what we have been, which is a fossil fuel-based economy, really. And as that economy is shaking a bit and our fossil fuel energy prices have escalated so much and the repercussion that that's had throughout Wall Street and the economy, that how do we transition that back to that more local basis?
What are you doing about energy? What are the sources of energy in transition communities?
A lot of places are looking at the renewable energy. The first thing we look at is conservation,
mm-hmm.
because the amount of energy efficiency that is involved is probably, you know, the biggest area that we can have the most impact for the littlest buck, basically.
Right.
Get the most bang for the dollar here. And so that's the first thing that we look at, is just reducing our energy overall and looking at that in a really holistic sense. It's not just miles that I drive and how big my electric bill is, but it's the energy that goes into everything that I consume and how far those things have to travel, how they're processed, all of those pieces. So we look at conservation, first of all, and energy efficiency. We have been working to create some relationships with student organizations. I know we had some conversations with a young man, Timothy Denherter Thomas, out of McAllister College graduate who has started a group called Summer of Solutions, and he places interns that have been trained in energy efficiency in different communities around the country, and they spend a summer actually working on weatherization and insulation and all of those pieces for reducing energy costs and energy consumption, and looking at placing some of those students in transition initiatives so that the struggle that Summer of Solution has is finding neighborhoods that they can go into without having a lot of prior relationship in order to implement their solutions. And that's the strength of transition towns, is they are working on developing those relationships. So when the two partner up, then transition basically can open the door and provide the avenue for Summer of Solution students.
Interesting. Is all of this very official? Do you announce that you're a transition town and then people will come and help you?
Well, it can be. There are a lot of, I would say that there are over 20 groups in the Twin Cities in Minnesota that would identify themselves as transition initiatives or transition neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of them at this point is official. To be officially recognized is basically to go to the organization, the national organization, Transition US, and to contact the executive director and say, this is what we're thinking about and this is where we're at. Becoming official is merely a matter of an application, and it's a matter of Transition US looking at the initiative and looking at the energy that's there and giving official status if they think that you've met the criteria to be an initiative that can be successful. So they, if you're not in that place yet, if you've got one really excited, dynamic person, and that's about it, then they would put you in as a mulling group. Means you're mulling it over yet, and you haven't quite got all the pieces in place that you're going to need. But once they think that you have the capacity to actually really make this happen in your community, then they put you on official status. And really the difference, all that means in the difference of that is that the communities then recognize each other and can go to each other for looking at what projects you're working on, looking at things that you've done and going, hey, you know, that looks like a really good idea. We're thinking about that here. Let's connect. Let's talk to each other. Tell us what worked. Tell us what didn't work. One of the biggest pieces of transition is sharing both your successes and your struggles.
Right.
So that we can learn from each other, mm-hmm. and possibly even sharing resources. If you've already developed all these materials for this neighborhood program, why would I reinvent that?
Sure.
So it's those kinds of things that official status basically can bring to you.
We're mulling transitions this hour of the program with Patricia Benson, a board member of Transition US, and she's also living in a transition community. She's been working on market gardening, environmental education, advocacy for environmental justice for many, many years now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. She's a member of the initiating group of Transition Northfield in Minnesota. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Bill Moyers will be with us. He has a new book, Bill Moyers Journal, The Conversation Continues. It's a book, he says, of ideas, and he hopes stimulating conversation, one that you can dip into at will. It exists because the issues and the ideas discussed remain pertinent in the here and now. Their significance did not end when the closing credits rolled. He has interviews with a number of people, John Stewart, Michael Pollan, Nikki Giovanni, Richard Goldstone, Robert Bly, Jeremy Scahill. We have to have Jeremy on. I wonder what he's up to right now. We haven't seen him in a long time. Wendell Potter and Thomas Cahill, many other people who've been on our show as well. So we'll talk about all of that with Bill Moyers tomorrow during this time period. To your phone calls for Patricia, Annette in Madison is our first caller. Hi, Annette. Hi, Annette.
Hi.
Hi.
I live in Madison, and I wanted to let you know that we have something similar to the system you're talking about. It's called a time bank. No exchange of money, but exchange of time. And you just sign up and list your skills, and then if someone can put in or fix a leaky faucet, and you see that in the time bank listings, you contact that person. They bank their hours that it takes, or their time that it takes to do the task, and then when they need their lawn mowed or their help with their taxes or a word processing document, they can use their hours to get that help in exchange. And I'm sorry, I'm just pulled off the road to chat, but I'll take your comments off the air.
Do you
very
Annette,
interesting program?
Yeah, but before you go, how do people find out about the time bank?
Well, we advertised it in our local kind of Northside News and Shopper, but it's available just to go online.
Oh, okay.
And then you can find the local contact to who is helping sign up.
All right, great. Thanks, Annette. Well, there's a dandy idea.
Yeah, there are a couple of different models out there, and it's very effective, actually. I do need to correct one of the things that was in my bio. I think you pulled off of the Transition US website. I am no longer in Northfield. I was part of the initiating team there, but I am on the first cutting edge of that wave of unemployment and trying to create a relocalized economy. So I basically lost my house in Northfield. I ended up getting a short sale on it to avoid foreclosure.
Oh, dear.
And I'm living on a farm up in Eden Valley, Minnesota. So I've just moved into deeply rural Minnesota. And I'm in the process right now. I'm renting a farm site, a building site, and am raising chickens, and I'm bartering chickens, the finished product, for the organic feed that I'm supplementing their pasture with. So the barter system is alive and well in rural Minnesota as well.
I would imagine. Oh, I didn't know where to imagine you, but it's in a totally different place than where I thought.
Yes, it's no longer Northfield. Yeah. And this is definitely a different place, but it's a wonderful community. So, I think that the bartering system, the bank time banks, or if it's an organized system in a larger sense for community-wide, or in a small sense like neighbor-to-neighbor, just trading or sharing equipment and tools and things like that, kind of harkens back to some of our rural roots when we did more of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and such a natural thing to do if we're engaged with each other, right? If we know our neighbors and if we share some of the same values.
Right, if we're in relationship, and that's the piece that I really think sets transition apart, is creating that relationship. And also dealing with transition focuses on all of this as being a matter of inner transition, not just what we do on the outside in projects and, you know, sustainability, you know, practices on the ground, but also looking at how we are in relationship with each other, in relationship with the earth, and how we deal with our dependence on our current society's dependence on fossil fuels, on cheap energy, on cheap oil. Back in, I think it was 60s or early 70s, my parents built a home, and they had 2x4 exterior walls. Well, oil was really cheap. Price per barrel was really cheap, and it didn't make sense to invest in the lumber for a deeper wall and more insulation when the fuel was that inexpensive. And now those homes are very energy inefficient, and we've, you know, increased the insulation capacity of our buildings because of energy prices. And we've got a real dependence on that cheap energy, and we're going to have to make that shift away from it. And that means a lot of change. And change for a lot of people is very, very difficult. And so part of what transition is about is also addressing that. It's not just saying, you know, rah, rah, let's take to the bikes, but which is a very, very valid thing. But it's also saying we need to look at our hearts. We need to look at our personal internal response to all of this, and we need to cope with, almost as an addiction, our lifestyle and how that's going to have to change. And we need to deal with the emotional aspects of that and the personal grief that we're going to possibly feel as we go through this whole thing.
They are very big changes that you're talking about, very big changes.
To get to where we need to be, yes. I mean, I know right now with everything that's been going on with unrest in the world that we're looking at some energy shortages. We've just released an energy reserve, our oil reserves, to try to buffer some of that. But we're looking at some major, major changes in our lifestyles. And those are not going to be any major change that we have in our personal lives is not easy.
Lori is next from Viroqua. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good morning. Viroqua is in the early stages of looking at transition towns. I'm wondering if you have any specific examples or strategies for bringing together, you know, pretty divisive communities. You know, you live in a rural area now. I mean, here, you know, a big, you know, deal is how long you've lived here. And, you know, you've got the old community and the newcomers, and fortunately, this transition is being spearheaded by the newcomers. I've heard that Sandpoint, Idaho has been very successful in bringing together a diverse population. I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, I think diversity is a challenge for all of us at any point in whatever situation that we're in. But a lot of what we need to do in any situation like that is a great deal of respectful listening and authentic listening and building those relationships. If you look at, I think what's made Sandpoint effective is that what they're really looking at is what do we want our community to become? Do we want healthy citizens? Do we want access to health care? Do we want safety and security? Do we want energy prices that we can afford? Do we want a community that's got that, well, it is customarily referred to as kind of that small town feel, the neighborhood feel, that we're connected and inclusive And a lot of us, even if our motivation is different for getting involved, we share those values of what we're looking for in our community. We want a vibrant, thriving community. If it's resilient and sustainable, that's also, you know, what we're going for here. So most of us can agree on the end product to a certain extent. I think the piece that I have found to cause the most tension getting people engaged is if we insist that everyone has to possess my motivation for getting involved. They have to, you know, drink the Kool-Aid of peak oil or climate change. They have to believe that in order to be involved. And personally, I don't think that's true. I think that we want to build healthy communities. I've yet to find people who don't want to live in a healthy community. So if we can create that vision of the healthy community and work toward that, perhaps my reason for wanting that is to have a sense of connection. Perhaps my reason for wanting that, you know, more walkable cities is to deal with our obesity problem and health issues in the United States. Perhaps it's the blue zone, you know, the really healthy communities in the sense of personal health. Maybe it's aspects of that that help me to get involved in creating this resilient, dynamic, and thriving community. So if we can focus on that positive vision without insisting that everyone that gets involved buys into my personal worldview or motivation, that I think is the point where we have the greatest success in making it all come together, is that inclusiveness and openness and just allowing people to be who they are and believe what they believe. And send out the invitation to be part of this movement to create a vibrant, healthy community and see where it takes us.
Thanks, Lori. Along the same lines, George in LaPointe. Hi, George.
Hi. Superior program. And your guest is outstanding. I have a comment and a question. My comment is one of the best books on transitions that I've ever read, and I've been involved professionally in this area, is a book called Transitions by William Bridges, and I'd strongly recommend it to your guest. Transitions by William Bridges. It's a small book, but it's outstanding. And my question is, you've recognized this. This is a personal and relational kind of activity. What do you do to help people learn to deal with differences which are normal? Most of us haven't learned to do that.
I'm not 100% sure I'm understanding what you're asking.
Well, whenever you get a group of people together, there are going to be differences.
Right.
And how do you teach people to manage those differences in a healthy way?
Wow, this might be out of my scope. For me, a lot of it is just building relationship and focusing on the relationships. And just like in relationships in my personal life, there's a lot of diversity. There are people that I have that are great friends that I clearly do not share their worldview, but that doesn't mean that we can't work together and enjoy each other, you know. So we focus a lot on listening, and a lot of what I try to do is to get to the essence of how the message is framed. I think so often we're triggered by things that are sometimes language triggers or you know, we're grouped. We stereotype ourselves into different philosophical or political or ethnic or whatever. We have a culture that we carry with us, and we have ideas that we put on that culture that are maybe not accurate. And if we can distill our values down to the essence of what we do agree on, what we hold in common in value, and then move forward creating those values in our community, I think that's the way that we end up working together and building relationship. But the biggest thing is spending time with each other and listening to each other and respecting it, not in a formula basis, but truly wanting to get to know and understand each other. I moved from a very progressive community in Minnesota to a very conservative area, and I'm finding a lot of shared values. Huh. We might have different pathways for getting there, but I think there's a lot of shared value.
So you see this as a one-on-one thing rather than something the movement can help people learn to do?
Well, the movement is about building relationships, so it is one-on-one.
Okay, thank you.
It's one neighborhood, one street at a time, basically.
Okay, that helps. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. Now, let's talk more about this aspect of it. An article in The Guardian about this talked about local currencies. A local currency central to the transition plan. One of the organizers of a community in England said, think of it as a leaky bucket. Anytime we spend money with a business that's got more links outside the community than in it, we leak money from the local economy. What local currency does is allow that wealth to bounce around in that bucket. So I'm having a hard time understanding what kind of economy is built. How do you keep money? And if you could amplify on a local currency, what kinds of businesses are there in a community that can keep a community self-contained and keep money within that community?
Well, I know one of the best examples that there's a little film clip out. It's Transition, I think it's 1.0. And it, one of the things it talks about in there is this small bakery. And it's almost a subscription bakery. It's a bakery in England. And the couple that opened this bakery basically went around and did some what we would call community asset mapping to see what the needs and the desires of the community are. And then they basically created, they found a customer base and said, you know, if we build this bakery, how much bread would you be willing to buy? And they created a delivery route, and they bake for their customers. And instead of going to, you know, the local, I don't know what the equivalent chain is in the UK, but the local cub store or something like that to get bread, they now get it from a small local business. That small local business, in turn, does their advertising in the local newspaper. They do their shopping in the local community. So the dollars stay more local. Now, that's not a local currency, but that is a local economic model or a local business model. So the idea behind it is it's very similar to the other 350 movement. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the 350 movement that is about spending $50 at three different businesses every month that you don't want to see leave your community.
Mm.
So it's based on this local business idea, support your local businesses. And I think a lot of that has to do with, if you think about a community trying to attract jobs through a big box store, for example. So a large box store comes in, and usually the community makes some concessions. They make concessions on taxes. They make concessions on a lot of different things to attract this business to their community because it's going to provide 200 jobs or 500 jobs,
right,
whatever it is. But the difference is that a lot of those big systems, those big stores, all of their printing is done out of town. It's done in a corporate center and shipped. And they usually own the printer that's doing the, you know, production of their flyers. So all of that work is happening outside the community. When it happens inside the community, then that dollar bounces around, you know, 10 or 15 times inside your local community. It's strengthening the local economy. The leaky bucket idea is that when, you know, when you're supporting a business that's from outside the community like that, then those dollars actually leave your community. That printer that's putting together flyers for some huge box store is not taking any of that money and putting it back into the local economy. So that's the idea behind it. And a local currency, basically, we have lots of them. I mean, I don't think people really think about it that way, but I grew up in a community called New Prague, Minnesota, and New Prague was Czechoslovakian and had a New Prague checks. And they were basically, anytime you won anything from, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, you got paid in these New Prague checks, which could only be spent in town,
mm-hmm,
because they were the only people who honored them. Northfield has something like that through their chamber. They're called chamber bucks. And some of the local businesses buy the buy gifts for their employees, like Christmas bonus kinds of gifts, and they give them chamber bucks for that, which can only be used in the city of Northfield. So it's a way of reinforcing that local economy. The local currency idea takes that to a much greater degree and basically just creates a local currency that is exchanged at a much higher frequency and much higher level within the community. And I think that's the philosophy behind it, is that in doing that, then you're keeping that money within your local economy.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. More phone calls in a moment. Patricia Benson is our guest. We're talking about transition communities and welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open if you've been trying to get through. You can send an email as well, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now for Patricia, Ron in Blooming Grove. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Some principles seem to apply worldwide, and we ought to recognize that. For example, if we grow our wet foods that are sparse in nutrients, things like milk, vegetables, and fruits, very close by or even within our cities, that would be much smarter. In the Detroit metropolitan area, lots of people are starting to garden to grow some food there locally. The antithesis of that is flying spinach or cherries or whatever, plums, from Chile or New Zealand to North America. That's sort of the ultimate in stupidity. The flip side of that principle is that a lot of our foods that are naturally dry and high density in nutrients, things like grains or even cheese and non-fat dry milk, those could be grown and processed far away from the cities and then shipped to where the humans are at a fairly low low cost. Contrast shipping a semi-load of processed milk that is 1 or 2% fat with a semi-load of cheese or butter. It may have 10, 12, 15 times as much food value, calories, in the truckload if you extracted the water back out in the production area and only sent the real food into the cities. And that applies even greater when the food must be shipped a long distance. For example, if we're sending relief supplies to tsunami victims in Japan from Iowa or Kansas, having it a food that's 95% nutrients and 5%.
Are you still there, Ron? All right, well, we got the thrust of this. Patricia.
Right. Those kinds of ideas are part of what we're looking at when we talk about harvesting the collective genius of our communities, that transition doesn't really give specific answers to anything. We present the problem, but we don't really tell communities what it is that they should do. The idea is that we gather people together and we present the problem, and we trust that we have the same level of collective genius in our communities now that we had when we, you know, invented the wheel and put a man on the moon. You know, I mean, we still have that. We have that capacity. So by presenting the challenges and then inviting people to join the conversation, we're going to find people who have that expertise and who can contribute based on the local resources and capacity, who can contribute to developing that local commodities, local food supply, local economy, all of the pieces that we need, the consumer goods. And as we work to lessen our dependence on collecting stuff, and go more into quality versus quantity, and then relocalize it, that all these folks that have a tremendous amount of wisdom can participate in that process and collecting or putting together that collective vision, that positive vision, and then helping us to know what the best way is to get there. That's what it's all about.
Patricia, how much have you and those you know and care about been able to cut your cost of living?
Say that again?
How much have you been able to, how much has it cost you each year just to live? Have you, as a result of becoming involved in this, found that you were just spending a whole lot less money?
Yes, definitely. I was making $60,000 a year when I was working. I had a full-time job and a part-time job, and I was looking at eradicating debt and trying to install some solar and, you know, different pieces like that. Well, I lost the full-time job, and I went from that income to what I currently have is a $28,000 a year income. And one of the reasons that we moved was that the cost of living in Eden Valley is half of what it was in Northfield. We are now raising most of our food supply. We've got everything from drying beans for long-term storage to fresh fruits and vegetables. We have all of those things that we're producing because we dug up our lawn. We put in a food forest, basically, and a huge garden, and not only for ourselves, but also to share that. So part of what we're looking at doing is supplying. I mean, we see this coming, but there are a lot of people who aren't really on this train yet and haven't looked at this or haven't considered it or don't think that it's going to happen, have considered it and don't think that it's going to happen. But if I truly believe it, then I think I have a responsibility not only to care for my family, but also to make sure that there's a surplus and that that surplus is intended to be shared. So my energy use, I've used the Minnesota Energy Challenge with the Center for Energy and Environment in Minnesota to look at my energy use and figure out how I could reduce that. We've taken that down to less than half of where we were.
Oh, my.
And we don't have a Prius or, you know, we haven't done really big dollar things because we don't have the big dollars to do it with. But we are a family of five. I have three children right now who are all eligible drivers, one 21-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a 16-year-old. None of them are licensed. We're a single-car family. We're committed to using our bikes when we can, and we basically really just cut things back and found that we're living a very satisfied life. We've eliminated some things from our household completely. We're still working with the computers. We've got that piece going, but we've just eliminated the television from the household completely. So we spend a lot more time reading books and playing board games and really enjoying each other. And have a lot of kids coming over, which is kind of interesting. We have moved into this area in February, and we've got kids that are visiting our home from town, and we don't have any of the cool toys. So I'm not really sure what the draw is, but I think that that sense of connection and playing over a game of Monopoly versus, you know, some cool electronic thing actually has a draw for some of these kids, and they like coming out. One
I'm
of their
glad
favorite
to hear
things
that.
Is a tire swing.
Oh, always a hit. That's great. Tom in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi there. My name is Tom Brandsitter. I'm one of the founders of Transition Milwaukee.
Oh.
We've been at this for about 2.5 years now, and we just kind of winged it to get going on it after reading some books, and we got the Transition Handbook. I'm sorry, I came into this conversation fairly late, so I'm not sure what's all been talked about. But a lot of us were inspired by the handbook that Rob Hopkins wrote and decided to do our own. And in the meantime, I've met Richard Heinberg and a couple other important people in the movement. And last year, we decided to do something I don't think that anybody else in the country was doing. We decided to have a week-long event that was based off Heinberg's Power Down book, and we have a Power Down Week, where we try to live as grid minimal or off-grid as possible while being immersed in the grid. So we're building cob ovens, putting in rain gardens, rain barrels. There's a whole long list. It's a week-long event, and from solar showers, solar cooking, and all that. It's just a way to fast track a lot of things that's been talked about, but just do it all within a week and get together and do it all week long and turn it into a staycation. It's kind of hard to do this in the middle of winter in Wisconsin, but it just brings us all together. Instead of us all going off on a vacation somewhere, we vacation together and encourage each other and learn from each other. So that's all I want to see on it. But if anybody within the listening audience wants to check it out, just go to Transition Milwaukee's website, and then they can find the link to it there.
Okay. Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Tom. It would be nice to find out how things are being done in cities as well. We should talk about how large this is. How many communities are there now in the United States, and is that number going up?
Right now in the United States, we have 92 official transition initiatives, and I believe there's nearly 400 official worldwide. We have 28 states that are involved, 38 countries, 10 different languages. So, yes, it is growing. And as I said before, when I was talking about the Twin Cities, there are a lot of groups that have done what Milwaukee has done. Because I'm not sure, but I don't think there is a Transition Milwaukee that's official. And they've done a tremendous job, and we've actually featured their Power Down information on their Power Down movement on our Transition US website and in the newsletter. So, again, it's a movement. There is an organization that tries to support the movement and is trying to track some things and make sure trainings are, you know, happening and things like that. But it's basically a movement. And so we're looking at, you know, we're looking at growing numbers, but also a tremendous number of groups that consider themselves initiatives, like the 20-plus neighborhoods in Minneapolis-St. Paul that are not listed on any map.
Right.
So it is growing, and I think it's growing both in rural areas and also in metropolitan areas. And interestingly, moving into some really diverse communities and moving in that diversity, not only being a ethnicity or a cultural diversity, but also ideology, that we've got some really conservative areas that are initiatives. Sandpoint, Idaho, for example, is a fairly conservative area, and they were one of the first initiatives in the United States. There's a lot of different ways to connect to this.
Let's go to Ingrid in Madison. Hi, Ingrid.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for this
program.
I wanted to go back to the leaky bucket and ask about what the transition movement is doing for larger scale issues. I'm a private nurse midwife, and I get the one-to-one relationship community building really well. I invite my clients to pay me in other ways than through monetary ways, and I've been paid in landscaping and professional conference facilitation, and someone right now is working on beautiful bedroom closet doors for me, and it would never be so beautiful if if I didn't have a woodworker making those for me. House painting, I'm being paid off in eggs. They'll be paying a long time, but you know, all the maternity fees, labor, delivery, we can work that way. What I'm wondering about is really big healthcare costs, a healthcare system, or transportation, these large level needs that require a real sense of collective or a sense of commons. I've worked with the Amish. I know how they address their transportation and big healthcare cost needs, but we seem to lack that sense of commons in America, even on a statewide or community basis. How does the transition movement address those needs?
Well, I know that our overarching goal is to get communities to the point of an energy descent action plan. For short, we're calling it an EDAP, and different communities have different names for it. But ideally, what it is creating a plan that bridges a community from a high dependence on energy to a low dependence on energy. And quite honestly, healthcare is one of our biggest concerns. Healthcare and food production are both really high energy industries. And looking at how we're going to transition that into something that can be more functional is a major challenge. I know Northfield had a medicinal garden workshop a week or two ago where they were sharing herbs and helping people to understand how to plan and use a medicinal garden, because they're very concerned about what is going to happen in healthcare. Looking at the piece that you're talking about is where transition intersects with government. So we are our initial response here is setting up a local community and doing really that community engagement work that's focused on the things that we as communities can do. But as we get into that we as citizens are working on things, we're going to run into areas where policy prevents us from moving forward. And at that point, then we start engaging on policy issues to start pushing that forward. The transition movement has not taken official stand on political agendas. We basically don't, as a movement, don't get involved with that, because, again, we're looking at supporting the local community to be able to do what they can at a grassroots basis and to support them based on their resources and capacity and the different needs to move forward. So in some areas, that means, transportation that is bicycle-based is a lot easier, again, in a warm climate than it is in a winter climate. So looking at those alternatives, we can't say that, 50% of your community should be using their bikes 50% of the time. We can't really put a blanket statement like that on, or a guideline like that on the transition movement, because we've got communities all over the globe with totally different needs. So what we look at is when we get to that point where we run into policy, then we start engaging with the government, usually starting with the local government. In Northfield, you know, cities are going through budget cuts like crazy in Minnesota, everywhere, I'm sure, and we're looking at trying to wean our city from any outside income, basically, as a city council. We're looking at being independent of state funding because we're not sure it's going to be there. And so when we're trying to move forward with the Green Step City program, there were some challenges because we couldn't afford to hire a sustainability director or coordinator. So the transition group had suggested that transition could perhaps take up that role.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye and direct people to transition to get more information about this phenomenally interesting development. Thanks, Ingrid, very much for your call. And Patricia, thank you for your time. Patricia Benson, board member of Transition US, and you can Google that and get much more information about the origins. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for production and Rhonda Fanning on air production.